Welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona's weekly broadcast of the Arizona Mirror for Thursday, February 20th, 2025. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Joe Napoli. We have our weekly broadcasts of the Arizona Mirror, which is an online independent publication, and we focus on stories related to Arizona. The first one is titled, Arizona GOP Lawmakers Advance Firing Squad Execution Proposal by Gerald McDonald Evoy. A Republican proposal that would amend the Arizona Constitution to execute prisoners by firing squad instead of lethal injection passed its first hurdle Tuesday. If the measure ultimately passes both chambers of the legislature, it would go before voters in 2026. The sponsor, Scottsdale Republican Representative Alexander Kolodnin, repeatedly told the House Committee on Regulatory Oversight his House Concurrent Resolution 2024 was inspired by an independent review of the death penalty that Governor Katie Hobbs commissioned and later spiked. That draft report, written by retired federal magistrate Judge David Duncan, detailed the numerous problems the state has encountered when trying to procure the drug used for lethal injections. Hobbs hired Duncan in January 2023, shortly after she took office, and fired him in November 2024. The last execution performed by the state was done during the administration of Republican Governor Doug Ducey. Multiple judges and advocates, including Duncan, have spoken about the use of firing squads and recommended them as a way to continue executions in a more humane manner. Duncan concluded that although lethal injection appears to be painless and humane, the reality is that it is fundamentally unreliable, unworkable, and unacceptably prone to errors. Duncan also noted that executions are a violent act in every case. And Kolodnin also cited retired federal judge Alex Kozinski, who, in 2014, wrote in the Wall Street Journal that firing squad should be reinstated because it was foolproof, unlike legal injection. What I hear from these two judges is, if we are going to have these executions, we should drop the pretense, look it in the face, Jeannie Woodbury, a lobbyist representing the ACLU, said to the committee. No matter the method, the death penalty is cruel and inhumane. The committee also heard from conservatives concerned about the death penalty, a conservative advocacy group that has been urging state lawmakers across the country to rethink capital punishment. Nicholas Cote, the group's strategist, told the committee that Kolodnin's proposal does not address the real and immediate problem that is impacting the lethal injection process. The drug used to conduct the state's executions is shrouded in secrecy, leading to issues with procurement and transparency. Putting this in the Constitution seems like a real problem, Cote said, adding that firing squads have been used less than five times in the modern era, mainly in Utah, where the method was reinstated in 2015. Other states are also looking at bringing back the firing squad as a method of execution, including Idaho, where lawmakers are trying to make it the default form of execution. Recently, an inmate in Georgia lost a petition to have a death penalty sentence be imposed by a firing squad as opposed to lethal injection. President Donald Trump has also signaled his support of this method. Lawmakers also heard from a woman who previously worked as a correctional officer who worried about the emotional impact the death by firing squad would have on correctional officers. I have taken a life, and I promise you it never goes away, Tucson resident and veteran Courtney Quiñones Machado told the committee. Quiñones Machado said she has chronic nightmares from PTSD she received from her time in the military. I do not believe we need to traumatize correctional officers, she said, adding that retention rates for correctional officers in the state are already low, and making them participate in firing squad executions could worsen that. The Republicans seem unfazed by the concerns. What I have to say is this, Katie, if you are not capable of carrying executions that the people of Arizona want you to carry out because lethal injection is too hard for you, then we are giving you an easy way to do it, Kolodnin said, directly addressing the governor. Shortly after firing Duncan late last year, Hobbs' administration moved to quickly execute Aaron Gunches, who murdered a man in 2002. The Arizona Supreme Court last week issued a death warrant, and Gunches is set to be put to death next month. For committee chairman, Representative Joseph Chaplick, the method of execution comes down to the bottom line, and using a firing squad would be cheaper than procuring lethal injection drugs. I think it is a lot less expensive to do as well, and our job is to cut the budget of the state here, the Scottsdale Republican said. Culloden's proposal would retain existing language in the Constitution that would allow death row inmates who committed a crime prior to November 23, 1992, to choose to die in the gas chamber instead. The measure passed along party lines and will head to the full House for a vote next. If passed out of both chambers, it will head to the ballot in 2026. We stick with news from the state capitol with another article by Gerald McDonald Evoy titled, Hobbs Vetoes Republican Plan to End Election Day Ballot Drop-Offs. Republicans are considering a 2026 ballot measure to implement their plan to speed up Arizona election results. Governor Katie Hobbs vetoed a Republican proposal to speed up election results by adopting policies used in Florida that would have eliminated the way hundreds of thousands of Arizonans cast their ballot each year. Senate Republicans have called the idea wildly popular, and the Arizona Republican Party has been pushing a phone and email campaign to encourage Hobbs to sign it into law. But before House Bill 2703 had even been passed, its fate was known, after Hobbs declared she would veto it because Republicans were unwilling to make concessions. In response, Republicans lobbed the same accusation at the governor. The bill passed through the House of Representatives on February 12th by a vote of 32-27, and it cleared the Senate a day later by a vote of 16-10. In both chambers, only Republicans voted in favor. Among the changes HB 2703 would have made is ending the practice of voters dropping off their early ballots at a polling place on Election Day, and instead require that they either go to the county recorder's office if they want to drop off a ballot after 7 p.m. on the Friday before Election Day, or stand in line at a polling place to show ID before inserting their ballot in a ballot tabulator. More than 264,000 Arizonans, nearly 8% of voters who cast a ballot, dropped off their early ballots on Election Day in November, according to the Secretary of State's office. The bill would have also required voters on the active early voting list who receive a ballot in the mail automatically to confirm their address each election cycle or be booted off the list, and it sought to mandate that schools serve as polling locations if the county requested. Additionally, it would have expanded in-person early voting through the day before Election Day instead of ending it on the Friday before. While I, too, want faster election results, the solution should not needlessly restrict Arizona citizens' freedom to vote or undermine the learning and safety of students in public school districts, Hobbs wrote in her veto letter. This legislation effectively ends the active early voting list, something that has nothing to do with faster election results, but disenfranchises voters by adding additional steps for the hundreds of thousands of Arizona voters who prefer to vote by mail. Hobbs has repeatedly said she would veto any legislation that makes it more difficult to vote and outline the compromises she said she was willing to make in order to make the legislation work. This bill is her first veto of the 2025 legislative session. Proposed changes included Friday early ballot drop-off restrictions while protecting the active early voting list and some combination of same-day voter registration, cross-county portability of voter registration, and expanded assistance for eligible voters to return their ballots in a timely manner, Hobbs explained in her letter. A negotiated bill that included some of these provisions would have shown Arizonans that it's possible to both speed up counting and expand voter access. Hobbs said in her letter that Republicans rejected those proposals. Senate Democratic leader Priya Sundaresan echoed Hobbs, saying that Republicans rejected their proposals in a video statement on the veto posted on X. Republicans attempted to use this moment as an excuse to reduce voter access under the guise of having election results called earlier, when, in reality, expanding voter access and achieving faster election results are not mutually exclusive, Sundaresan said. I want to give my sincere thanks to Governor Hobbs for vetoing this measure and safeguarding Arizonans' right to vote and make their voices heard. Sundaresan's Democratic colleagues in the House made similar statements. Senate President Warren Peterson called the veto a huge mistake in a press release shortly after Hobbs announced the veto. This was a missed opportunity to increase voter confidence and reduce frustration on election night, Peterson, a Queen Creek Republican, said in a written statement. Instead of working with Republicans in good faith to provide much-needed reforms to the election process, the governor impeded all efforts to ensure Arizona can report the vast majority of votes on election night. This is not what Arizonans want from their state's leaders. Republicans and Democrats should be able to work together to solve these issues in a bipartisan manner without resorting to political talking points. The statement went on further to say the Republicans are weighing options on how to continue to pursue the legislation. Last year, Republican lawmakers sent a record number of ballot referrals to the voters to avoid Hobbs's veto pen. Status quo for our state's elections is not an option. Arizona should never again be the laughingstock of the nation for its woefully slow election reporting. Our caucus will be discussing a path forward on this issue in the days and weeks ahead, Peterson said. Republicans have a similar proposal, House Concurrent Resolution 2013, which would be sent to voters in 2026 if approved by both chambers. House Speaker Steve Montenegro directly alluded to the measure to voters in a post on X after the veto. Governor Hobbs and Democrat legislators continue to block reforms aimed at ensuring timely and transparent election results, Montenegro said. If they won't act, we will, letting the Arizonans, voters, have the final say. Katie Hobbs failing to sign even the most common sense bill being placed on our desk, it's pathetic, Republican Governors Association spokesperson Colin Crompton said in a statement. Arizona logs the nation the time it takes to count ballots and report results. The insane wait on reporting results is bad for governance and causes chaos and uncertainty for voters, elected officials in the country. To voters, this is common sense, and clearly Hobbs has none. Last November, Arizona was the last state which the Associated Press called the presidential election results. The state has typically reported its full results about 13 days after the election for the past two decades. Republicans began making a policy point of the count when Arizona started to become a swing state and the margins of victory became more narrow in many races. The bill would have curbed the drop-off of late earlies at polling locations in a voter's county by 7 p.m. on the Friday before Election Day. Currently, voters can drop off their mail-in ballots at any polling place through 7 p.m. on Election Day. More than 264,000 Arizona voters drop off their early ballots on Election Day, according to the Secretary of State's office. By the way, you can listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device. We stick with political news with another article from the keyboard of Gerald McDonald Evoy titled AG Backs Bill to Let Cops Shoot Down Cartel Drones Despite a Federal Ban on Doing So. Amid an increase in cartel drones flying over the state's southern border, GOP lawmakers and the Democratic Attorney General say that local police should be able to shoot them out of the sky without fear they'll be sued. And that's precisely what a proposal that Representative David Marshall, Republican of Snowflake, would do. His House Bill 2733 would give local law enforcement immunity from liability for damage to personal property if they are shooting down a drone they believe is engaged in criminal activity. But even if state law is expanded to allow cops to shoot down drones, federal law still bans shooting at any aircraft, including drones. Attorney General Chris Mays, who said she worked with Marshall on the proposal, said it's a critical change to the law that will directly aid in combating the flow of drugs into Arizona. These drones are on an increase, Mays said at a February 17th press conference, telling reporters that cartels have been using them to both transport drugs and conduct surveillance on Border Patrol agents. Airspace around the borders of the United States is heavily controlled and monitored by the U.S. military and the Federal Aviation Administration. NORAD has previously reported that drone incursions at the southern border have seen a market increase on inexpensive consumer drones have proliferated. When asked if Mays or the bill's sponsor had spoken with the FAA or NORAD about the proposed legislation, Mays said they planned to reach out. The FAA told the Arizona Mirror that it is against federal law to shoot at an aircraft. An unmanned aircraft hit by gunfire could crash, causing damage to persons or property on the ground, or it could collide with other objects in the air, the FAA said in a statement. Shooting at an unmanned aircraft could result in a civil penalty from the FAA and/or criminal charges from federal, state, or local law enforcement. The FEA did not respond to questions about whether it opposes the bill. NORAD did not respond to repeated requests for comment. Mays and Marshall dismissed the concerns about the possible damage to personal property or accidental shooting of drones that do not belong to cartels. "There's nothing good happening on the border at midnight," Marshall said, adding that drone incursions occur mainly at night. "I believe and trust our law enforcement to do the right thing and shoot these drones down at a safe location," Mays said, later adding that law enforcement should blow them out of the sky. Drones have long been a growing concern for both local and federal law enforcement at the border. Customs and Border Protection uses specialized drone jammers to disable unmanned aircraft that are flying illegally. Drones have been spotted at critical facilities, including an incursion involving a drone swarm at the Palo Verde nuclear power plant in 2019. May said she'd be interested in getting drone jammers to local law enforcement as well as to critical facilities across the state to combat this growing concern. Drones have proliferated in the past few years with multiple uses from law enforcement, firefighting, and even land surveying. It is unclear how the measure would account for drones operating legally within the border region. We stick with news from the state capitol with an article titled GOP Arizona ICE Act Forcing Local Police into Immigration Enforcement Clears Its First Hurdle. Critics say the measure would burden local law enforcement to assist Trump's mass deportation plans. By Gloria Rebecca Gomez. Republicans in Arizona are barreling ahead with a proposal that could force local police officers to comply with the federal government's immigration policies, despite warnings from Latino Arizonans and the wife of a U.S. veteran who was detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials last month that doing so will only lead to more unfair arrests. On January 22nd, Marlon Perez, an Iraq War veteran and legal permanent resident who has lived in the country for more than 30 years, was arrested outside of his home in Levine. His wife, Tanisha Hartwell Perez, continues to work toward his release while juggling a family business, the needs and emotional well-being of their 7 children, and a newfound role in immigration advocacy. On Monday, she testified against Senate Bill 1164, urging lawmakers on the Senate Military Affairs and Border Security Committee to reject the proposal and pointing to her husband's case as proof that state law enforcement agencies shouldn't entangle themselves in federal immigration policies that could get it wrong. Marlon actually has papers from ICE and the Department of Homeland Security stating that he can actually stay in this country, she said. He is now currently detained, even with all the proper documentation, so I can only imagine what would happen with somebody that doesn't have that. In 2011, Marlon was convicted of conspiracy to distribute drugs. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security later gave him a signed letter of no interest in recognition of the nonviolent nature of his crime and his military service. But 2 days after Trump's inauguration, ICE officials surrounded Marlon outside his home. Denise said she believes the Republicans' campaign promises to oversee a mass deportation campaign changed the federal government's immigration enforcement priorities to place Marlon, who would otherwise be a low priority, for removal in the crosshairs. And a GOP-led bid to strengthen the relationship between ICE and Arizona law enforcement agencies on the grounds that doing so will increase public safety is causing alarm among immigrant communities and civil liberties groups who say it will only serve to realize Trump's mass deportation plan. Dubbed the Arizona ICE Act, the proposal directs every law enforcement agency in the state to use its best efforts to support the enforcement of federal immigration law. While that statement has no clear guidelines for when, or even if, law enforcement agencies can refuse to comply with federal immigration enforcement policies, the rest of the bill's provisions increase the degree to which police departments must cooperate with ICE officials. State, city, town, and county employees would be barred from taking any action to limit the involvement of local police officers with immigration officials. That would likely void a 2018 citywide resolution passed by Phoenix's city council prohibiting the conscription of city police officers for any federal deportation force that remains on the books. ICE officials would also be able to request that any person in the custody of any police department in the state they suspect of being in the country illegally be held for an extra 48 hours, even if that person has yet been convicted of a crime, and even if ICE agents have no probable cause. Currently, police departments have the option to cooperate with those written requests called ICE detainers, or obey only those issued with their judicial approval. The bill also threatens legal consequences for police departments or correctional facilities found to be falling short of its directives. The state attorney general be authorized to take negligent agencies to court, and any Arizonan could trigger an investigation from the state's top prosecutor into their local law enforcement agency. The proposal, which originally mandated that all police departments join 287G agreements or similar federal immigration enforcement programs, has prompted several public protests in the past month. Monday was no different, as opponents packed the hearing room to voice their opposition and rallied outside the Capitol Plaza to demonstrate against it. But Chairman David Gowan, a Republican who represents Sierra Vista, limited public testimony to just a handful of speakers. Noah Schramm, the border policy strategist for the Arizona branch of the American Civil Liberties Union, warned that bill could lead to frivolous investigations prompted by citizens who believe local police departments should be doing more to enforce federal immigration laws. And the state would be fitting the bill for those investigations and lawsuits, but GOP lawmakers didn't include any money for local police agencies to cover the costs. Douglas Cuffe, Marlin's lawyer, told lawmakers on the panel that ICE detainers could represent constitutional rights violations. Well, Republicans have defended the bill as ensuring that undocumented people who commit crimes aren't released without repercussions. Cuffe pointed out that extended detentions undermine a person's right to due process. In this country, we have a presumption of innocence until proven guilty, he said. The mere evidence that somebody is arrested doesn't mean they've necessarily committed a crime. Cuffe added that many immigrants have legal authorization even if they aren't citizens. Asylum seekers, for example, must live in the country as permanent residents for 6 years or more before they can be eligible for citizenship. But they are among the groups who are legally allowed to stay in the country. And while some asylum seekers apply for work permits and driver's licenses, not all of them are able to work or drive due to age or infirmity, which means they simply don't have such legal documentation on hand to deter a potential ICE detainer. Democrats in the committee were unanimously opposed to the bill, voicing concern about its impact on immigrants and mixed-status families in Arizona and the burden on law enforcement agencies across the state. Senator Catherine Miranda, Democrat of Phoenix, said the measure would worsen public safety. There will be reduced reporting of violent crimes by vulnerable communities because they won't act as witnesses out of fear of deportation, she said. There will be increased response times for our law enforcement. Most major agencies are short-staffed and overextended. But Republicans, who control the chamber and outnumbered Democrats on the panel, backed the measure, saying it's necessary to preserve public safety. Senator Janae Schamp, Republican of Surprise, pointed to Lake and Riley's murder in Georgia as proof of the Arizona's ICE Act's necessity to ensure Arizonans are protected from undocumented people who commit crimes. Jose Ibarra, a Venezuelan immigrant who was convicted on the 26-year-old nursing student's murder in 2024, was previously detained in 2023 on a shoplifting charge and later released. The case has been used by Republican politicians to justify hostile immigration policies and inspired a federal law named after Riley that allows the indefinite detainment of undocumented people accused of low-level crimes, including shoplifting. Schamp, who sponsored the Secure Border Act that 63% of Arizonans approved last year, which made it a state crime for migrants to cross the Arizona-Mexico border anywhere but an official point of entry, touted those results as an impetus to act. This is about making Arizona safer, and the fact of the matter is the citizens of Arizona overwhelmingly voted to secure our border, she said. Our federal government is not going to do it, then we have to do it. Outside the committee chambers, Latino Arizonans and immigrant rights advocates gathered to denounce the bill and a host of other anti-immigrant measures which critics have begun to refer to as the Arizona Families Deportation Agenda. holding up signs reading "These racist bills have got to go" and "Immigrants make America great," protesters circled around prominent activists who spoke out against the proposal. Tyler Montaug with the American Business Immigration Coalition said the state shouldn't be involved in a federal program. ABIC advocates for immigration reform at the federal level and has pushed for pro-immigration policies in Arizona, including a voter-backed measure that granted undocumented students in-state tuition at Arizona's public colleges and universities. "We don't oppose removing dangerous people from the community. We acknowledge that there are dysfunctional parts of federal immigration law that need to be fixed and approved, but the answer is not a state-level enforcement-only provision that requires our local police department to make their best efforts at enforcing federal immigration law," Montague said. "That's what will break up families. That's what could devastate our workforce." Raquel Turan, a former Democratic lawmaker who started her political career opposing the state's notorious "Show Me Your Papers" law, encouraged attendees to continue mobilizing and then called on them to return to the state capitol next week. Lawmakers, she said, need to be confronted with the public's disapproval. "We keep going, we are here, and we're not leaving," she yelled in Spanish to raucous cheers. We have some agricultural news in an article titled "Arizona Cattle, Milk Tests Positive for Bird Flu" by Gerald McDonald, Envoy. The Arizona Department of Agriculture announced Friday that bird flu has been detected in milk produced by dairy cows in Arizona. Arizona is one of approximately 12 states that have confirmed cases of avian flu that are being monitored by federal, state, and local health officials. There is no evidence of human-to-human transmission of the virus in Arizona or anywhere else, and the risk to the public is considered low. In a press release Friday, the Agricultural Department announced that a dairy herd in Maricopa County had been put under quarantine after the virus was detected in milk they produced. "None of the cattle in the herd have displayed symptoms," they said. Transmission of the virus from cattle or birds to human is low, though people who interact with cattle are at higher risk. A recently released federal study found that bird flu infections of veterinarians appear to have been underreported and gone undetected. The virus is often fatal to birds and some other animals. It was recently reported that 5 animals at the World Wildlife Zoo and Aquarium in Litchfield Park died after being exposed to the virus. Other cases reported in Arizona include geese at a park in Scottsdale and 2 workers at a poultry farm in Pinal County who contracted the virus from birds at the farm but fully recovered. Other cases have been reported at a wastewater plant in Flagstaff and a backyard poultry flock in Maricopa County. Health officials have been advising people to avoid raw milk where the virus has been found. Raw milk has become a fad among conservatives. Right-wing influencers, including Phoenix-based Turning Point USA, have promoted debunked misconceptions around the health benefits of raw milk. The virus was detected in the dairy farm due to testing that has been taking place since January. The AZDA said that every dairy farm in Arizona has been tested at least once this year. Domestic and wild animals are at risk of infection from the virus, with backyard flocks being especially susceptible. Cats, dogs, and dairy cattle can all contract the virus, and humans can become infected after being exposed to an infected animal. Those with backyard flocks or pet birds should look out for symptoms such as low energy or appetite, purple discoloration or swelling of various body parts, reduced egg production or misshapen eggs, coughing, sneezing, and lack of coordination. People with cats and dogs should look for fever, lethargy, low appetite, reddened or inflamed eyes, discharge from the eyes and nose, difficulty breathing, seizures, or sudden blindness. Veterinarians recommend avoiding giving your pet raw milk and making sure they have not eaten a dead bird or any other animal. In humans, the virus can cause mild to severe upper respiratory symptoms and multi-organ failure and death. The current strain, called Eurasian H5N1, has proved to be deadly for wild birds, killing bald eagles, great horned owls, Canadian geese, snow geese, and other wild birds. The virus has been detected in over 150 wild birds in Arizona, according to the Centers for Disease Control. You can report sick and wild birds by calling the Arizona Game and Fish Department at 623-236-7201. And if you need to report a sick domestic bird, contact the Arizona Department of Agriculture at 602-542-4293. You are listening to our weekly broadcast of articles from the Arizona Mirror for Thursday, February 20th, 2025. I'm your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Joe Napoli. You can now take Sun Sounds with you on our new app for both Android and iPhone. Next, we turn to an article titled, Thousands of Arizona Children Now Waitlisted for State Child Care Assistance, by Maria Pauleta Asir. More than 2,000 Arizona children have been waitlisted for state child care assistance, according to the Department of Economic Security, and that number is likely to climb as the agency reviews pending applications. The waitlist counts quietly added to the DES website after weeks of inquiries from AZCIR publicly quantify for the first time the impact of state lawmakers' failure to fill a gaping budget hole left by expiring federal pandemic funds last year. The DES had warned state leaders that declining to address the shortfall would likely force the agency to reinstate its waitlist, which had taken a decade to eliminate. The current waitlist for subsidies designed to help families in need pay for child care while guardians work, job hunt, or go to school or training took effect August 1st. It applies to new applicants, minus those the state cannot legally turn away. The reality is that the funding we get from the federal government for the CCDBG, Child Care and Development Block Grant, is not enough to support the whole system, said Barbie Prinster, director of the Arizona Early Childhood Education Association. This is why we have a wait list, because we don't have enough state funding to make up the difference. This has been the case at least since the Great Recession, when lawmakers slashed and ultimately eliminated state child care funding to balance the budget. The $12 million in state dollars approved in 2024 marked the first time a Republican-led legislature had agreed to spend general fund money on child care in almost 15 years. Still, the amount fell far short of the $100 million Governor Katie Hobbs had requested to temporarily stabilize the state's child care system and avoid reinstatement of a waitlist. Republican lawmakers don't seem particularly receptive to the even more ambitious child care plan the Democrat released in January either. It proposes a public-private partnership that would allow the state, businesses, and families to share the cost of care, among several other initiatives. Despite some bipartisan support for increased child care funding at the federal level, the future of those dollars is also uncertain amid the ongoing blitz of spending freezes and budget cuts under the Trump administration. Chances that Arizona's waitlist will be swiftly eliminated through falling caseloads or increased funding, the two possibilities offered by DES, seem slim, and the agency has yet to publicly address the scope of the problem, failing to acknowledge repeated requests by AZCIR to provide the number of cases still awaiting review. In the second week of February alone, DES added more than 300 children to the waitlist. Being waitlisted indefinitely can spur parents who would otherwise be working or in school to turn down promotions, cut back their hours, or quit. Those decisions, in turn, can have a sweeping impact on Arizona's economy overall. In 2023, a Ready Nation analysis largely funded by the Helios Education Foundation estimated that insufficient child care led to a $4.7 billion loss in earnings, productivity, and revenue for the state. The child care waitlist is just more proof of what we've been saying. Arizona families and businesses are struggling with a system that isn't working, Danny Seiden, president of the Arizona Chamber of Commerce and Industry, told AZCIR via email. Employers across the state tell us all the time that the lack of affordable child care is keeping people out of the workforce and making it harder to hire. Seiden pointed out that it costs the state far more to financially support a family with no income at all than to help a working parent with child care costs, He said the state needs to look at real, bipartisan solutions that not only increase funding where it's needed, but also incentivize businesses to offer benefits to support working parents without imposing new burdens on employers. Prinster, the longtime advocate for child care reform, simply said that when not everyone has access to child care, especially low-income families, the economy and employers suffer. Child care needs to be affordable and accessible for everyone that needs it, she said. This article first appeared on Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting and is republished here under a Creative Commons license. We turn to Indigenous Affairs with an article titled, Havasupai Tribe Blasts Energy Fuels Navajo Nation for Cutting It Out of Uranium Hull Talks, by Shandon Silversmith. Uranium hull trucks are once again leaving the Pinyon Plain Mine, and the Havasupai Tribe describes the action of the state and the Navajo Nation permitting this hauling as a disregard for the health risks and dangerous implications of uranium mining. Energy Fuels, Inc. restarted hauling uranium ore from the Pinyon Plain Mine after a nearly six-month pause. In January, the mining company signed an agreement with the Navajo Nation to allow the trucks to pass through Navajo land. The Navajo Nation is not the only tribe or community affected by this activity, the Havasupai Tribe said in a statement sent to the Arizona Mirror. This was a blatant disregard for others impacted by the hauling activity, which could have been avoided by allowing our voice to be heard. The transportation officially started on February 12th. As part of the agreement, the mining company must give the Navajo Nation 14 days' notice before any hauling occurs. The Havasupai Tribe received no notice. The Havasupai Tribe has complained that it should have been involved in the negotiations because the Pinyon Plain Mine is located in the tribe's ancestral homelands and the route passes by Red Butte Mountain, a sacred site for its people. We are deeply disappointed in Energy Fuels and the Navajo Nation for not including us in their discussions that ultimately led to the dangerous decision to allow hauling of radioactive material across our Aboriginal lands, the Havasupai Tribe said in a statement. The tribe stated that despite the support and advocacy efforts from many allies, along with numerous letters, phone calls, and personal appeals, their urgent requests to halt this life-threatening action have been disregarded. Energy Fuels owns and operates the Pinyon Plain Uranium Mine on U.S. Forest Service land in the Kaibab National Forest near the Grand Canyon. Numerous tribes, including the Navajo Nation, the Hopi Tribe, and the Havasupai Tribe, have ancestral lands there. As the guardians of the Grand Canyon, we, the Havasupai Baja, the Havasupai Tribe, have opposed uranium mining in and around our reservation in the Grand Canyon since time immemorial, the tribe said. We do this to protect our people, our land, our water, our past, our present, and our future. The Havasupai Tribe, which lives at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, has repeatedly said the mine poses risks to its drinking water, natural wonders, and sacred cultural sites. This is real for us. We live here, the tribe said in a statement. Our culture and traditions originate here, and we are knit together with who we are as individual tribe members and as a tribe. Since the company started mining, the Havasupai Tribe said it has been forced to witness the degradation of our Aboriginal lands that include mining site and surrounding areas. The company will transport uranium ore from the Pinyon Plain Mine near the Grand Canyon using 24-ton haul trucks and end dump trailers. Tarps will cover the uranium ore. The Navajo Nation reported the mining company has confirmed it will send two trucks daily through February and aims to increase this number in the coming months. Eventually, up to 10 trucks will make the trek each day. The trucks start from the Pinyon Plain Mine, which is located at the end of Forest Service Road 305AB, about 6 miles from the main highway. They start their journey by traveling along the gravel road through the dense trees of the Kaibab Forest, before reaching the main highway, State Route 64. Then the trucks pass Red Butte Mountain, where the main road sits about a half mile from the open area at the mountain's base. The Havasupai Tribe said despite the company's promises that mining is safe, it remains diligent in understanding the health risks of radioactive contamination and how it will impact its people. We will not give up. We owe that to our ancestors, our children, and the generations to come. We will fight on, the tribe said. Our next article is titled, Arizona Police Procedures Exposed in Massive Policy Database Hack by Gerald McDonald Evoy. Hackers who broke into the systems of a Texas-based company that develops internal policies, manuals, and other training material for law enforcement have published thousands of finished and draft procedure manuals for police departments across the country, including many in Arizona. Lexipol boasts that it works with thousands of police departments and first responders across the country to help them create policy and procedure manuals that are used to guide those agencies on a myriad of topics. The Arizona Mirror examined the over 8,500 files leaked by a hacking group, calling itself the Puppy Girl Hacker Polycule, and published by the nonprofit DDO Secrets that archives leaked and hacked material. The agencies that the Mirror found included in the leak are Chino Valley Police Department, Chandler Police Department, Bisbee Police Department, Flagstaff Police Department, Prescott Valley Police Department, Prescott Police Department, Lake Havasu Police Department, Maricopa Community College District Police Department, Buckeye Fire and Rescue Department, Pima County Community College Police Department, and La Paz County Sheriff's Office and the Phoenix Police Department. Many of the documents appear to be drafts, with blank statements to be filled in by local law enforcement agencies. In the case of the Phoenix Police Department, the policy manual that was in the leak, the oath that officers must take, was likely copied from a document made for an Oregon law enforcement agency as it refers to swearing to uphold the Oregon Constitution. The departments that responded to the Mirror's request for comment were unaware of the breach. Lexipol did not respond to a request for comment asking if they were notifying the agencies that were included in the hack. We have not received any information about this from Lexipol, Lake Havasu Police Department Sergeant Kyle Ridgway said in an email to the Mirror. We began using Lexipol in early 2013. At this time, there is no additional information I can provide. Many of the agencies already publicly post their policy and procedures manuals online, and some of the leaks are early drafts of those documents. Some said they were unconcerned with the breach, since the final documents are already publicly available. We are not particularly concerned about our policies being published, as they are already publicly available for transparency and accessibility, Flagstaff Police Department Sergeant J.L. Rintala said. Additionally, we have not engaged with Lexipol regarding this matter. Our organization has been using Lexipol services for over 10 years. Lexipol has come under fire for the work it performs for law enforcement agencies, particularly for its resistance to police reform and use of force policies it creates. Groups like the American Civil Liberties Union have accused the group of writing policies that aid in protecting law enforcement that acts unethically. And its policies have been criticized for crafting police policies that could lead to racial profiling and harassment of immigrants, as the ACLU has asserted. The ACLU of Washington claimed that Lexipol policies led to an incident where an officer in Spokane unlawfully detained the victim of a car wreck in order to let them be questioned by immigration authorities. Additionally, some critics have complained that the policy and procedure manuals and other documents created by Lexipol for public agencies are copyrighted by the company. Some of the agencies that responded to the Mirror made sure to mention that they have not used the company and have switched to other groups to help in crafting their policies. We have not been contacted directly by Lexipol in regard to this breach. However, we have transitioned away from Lexipol platform for our policy management to Power DMS, which is adopted across the city of Buckeye. We utilized them for 3 to 4 years, Buckeye Fire and Rescue Department Fire Chief Jake Rhodes said in an email to the Mirror. Maricopa Community College's Police Chief Blair Barfus said the agency has not been contacted by Lexipol and was unaware of the breach until the Mirror asked about it. Other police departments made similar statements. Barfus said while the breach is very concerning and upsetting, the information released is available to the public through a public records request. We aim to be transparent in how and why we perform our public safety efforts, Barfus said. The leak also includes documents that show Lexipol was demoting their product to fire departments, police, and local governments. Seanlyn Silversmith brings us another article titled, Trump's Unleash American Energy Order Sparks Concern About the Grand Canyon National Monument. President Donald Trump's executive order for unleashing American energy is sparking concern for the safety of federal lands within national monuments across the U.S., but especially in the Southwest, where Trump has targeted monuments before. During his first term, Trump eliminated environmental protections for two national monuments in Utah by reducing the size of Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante. The Biden administration restored both in 2021. With Trump's Unleashing American Energy order, the Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante national monuments are at risk again because they both hold large critical mineral reserves. As part of his executive order, Trump requested an immediate review of all agency actions that could potentially hinder the development of domestic energy resources, focusing on oil, natural gas, coal, hydropower, biofuels, critical minerals, and nuclear energy. His order requested that agency heads review all existing regulations, orders, guidance, documents, policies, settlements, consent orders, and any other agency actions. Trump gave agencies 30 days to create and implement action plans to suspend, revise, or rescind all agency actions identified as unduly burdensome. The Department of the Interior is fulfilling the President's request after Secretary Doug Burgum directed agency staff to promptly review all agency actions and submit an action plan detailing the steps to review and revise all public lands withdrawn under current law. The Department's deadline is February 18th. The secretarial order does not directly mention national monuments or outline what laws are to be reviewed, but it references 54 U.S.C. 320301 and 43 U.S.C. 1714, which are federal laws related to the Antiquities Act of 1906 and the Federal Land Policy and Management Act 1976. It's almost as if they were trying to sneak this by us, said Tim Peterson, the Cultural Landscapes Director for the Grand Canyon Trust, a nonprofit conservation organization. Peterson said these two laws are significant because the Federal Land Management Act section permits mineral withdrawals administratively, and the Antiquities Act enables presidents to establish national monuments. Peterson said mineral withdrawals remove public lands from mineral entry, which means there can be no new mining claims, oil and gas leasing, or geothermal leasing. The secretarial order stated that the departments should focus on advancing innovation to improve the United States' energy and critical mineral supply to provide a reliable, diverse, and affordable energy supply for the nation. The order also calls for updating the U.S. geological surveys of critical minerals, including uranium, and developing an action plan to prioritize mapping efforts to identify previously unknown critical mineral deposits. It seems to be targeting all presidentially designated national monuments under the Antiquities Act, said Amber Raimondo, the energy director for the Grand Canyon Trust, noting that both Democratic and Republican presidents have dedicated national monuments. Arizona has 19 national monuments, including the recently established Baja Navajo Itu-Kukuveni, which added more protections against mining to the Grand Canyon region. Tribes, conservation groups, and state leaders are concerned about the recently established monument and are calling on the Department of the Interior to honor and support it. The order threatens the Grand Canyon region in two significant ways. The Obama administration's 2012 mining plan, which is in place for 20 years before it needs to be renewed, and the added protection from the Baja Navajo Itu-Kukuveni ancestral footprints of the Grand Canyon National Monument. The secretarial order threatens both those layers of protection for the Grand Canyon region the tribes and communities have fought for years to attain, Raimondo said, and the order threatens them despite the massive support national monuments have. Polling conducted by the Grand Canyon Trust shows that over two-thirds of Arizona voters oppose reducing protections for national monuments, and 80% back Baja Navajo Itu-Kukuveni. In Utah, polling indicates that 71% of voters favor maintaining Bears Ears as a national monument, while 74% support keeping Grand Staircase Escalante as a national monument. Americans love their national monuments and want them to stay protected, Raimondo said. The newly designated monument was challenged in court when Arizona GOP leaders filed a lawsuit in 2024 to rescind Biden's designation because he did not have the power to do so. A federal judge dismissed the case in January, but the GOP leaders are now looking to the Trump administration to move on their request. Tribes in the region have worked closely with other conservation groups to advocate for the monument's designation in 2023. The monument protects thousands of historical and scientific objects, sacred sites, vital water resources, and the ancestral homelands of many indigenous communities. The lands of Baja, Navajo, Itukukuveni include cultural sacred places of the Havasupai tribe, Hopi tribe, Havalupai tribe, Kayab band of Paiute Indians, Las Vegas Paiute tribe, Moapa band of Paiutes, Paiute Indian tribe of Utah, Navajo Nation, San Juan Southern Paiute Tribe, Yavapai Abajo Apache Nation, Pueblo Zuni, and the Colorado River Indian Tribes. The monument's name comes from the indigenous names the Havasupai and Hopi gave to the area. In the Havasupai language, Baja Navajo means where indigenous peoples roam, while Itukukuveni means our ancestral footprints in the Hopi language. Arizona Senators Ruben Gallego and Mark Kelly sent a joint letter to Burgum sharing the importance of the Baja Navajo and calling on his reassurances they will not undo America's newest national monuments. Tribes and Arizona communities deserve to move on with the management planning process for this national monument rather than worry there may be attempts to remove it, the senators said in their joint letter. Given the importance of the monument to tribal nations and communities, our economy, and immense public support, we ask that you reassure Arizonans that Baja Navajo Itukukuveni National Monument will remain intact for generations to come, they added. Grand Canyon Trust Executive Director Ethan Omak stated in a press release that they strongly oppose any efforts to reduce the boundaries of national monuments, and these areas are world-class examples of national and cultural landscapes worthy of protection. Any attempts to roll back protections for these national monuments will be challenged in the courts and strongly opposed by the public, he added. Earth Justice Attorney Heidi McIntosh said the decision to review national monuments highlights the Trump administration's narrow-minded insistence to hand over one of the nation's most valuable resources, public lands, to the mining and oil and gas industries. Rather than protecting the cultural treasures of the world-renowned fossils, historic places, and one-of-a-kind ecosystems that monuments like Bears Ears, Grand Staircase Escalante, and Baja Navajo Itukukuveni hold, this administration wants to sell these lands to the highest bidder, McIntosh said in a statement. We stand ready to defend our national monuments alongside the tribes and local communities who advocated for their creation. We turn to economic news with an article titled, Billions of Dollars at Stake for Farmers Hit by Trump Funding Freeze, Pause on Foreign Aid, by Allison Winter. Farmers across the United States are finding themselves in precarious economic positions as they attempt to navigate a strained farm economy and a barrage of executive orders from the Trump administration that put some farm programs in limbo. In his first month in office, President Donald Trump has issued a flurry of executive orders to pause or cancel federal funding on a range of programs and grants, some of which go directly to farmers. Even though the administration has said it would not stop payments to individuals and courts have ordered the administration to resume the programs, many farmers are left awaiting payments on their contracts and have not been told when or if they can expect to receive expected funding. Billions of dollars are at stake. Missouri cattle producer Scott R. Holden signed a $240,000 cost-sharing contract with the U.S. Department of Agriculture to improve water systems on his 260-acre cattle operation. After getting approval in January for the next phase of the project and investing upwards of $50,000 in pipes, equipment, and labor, Holden says he got a call a week later from his field agent telling him the payments from USDA were on hold. I instantly asked, what does this mean for all this money I just spent that I'm relying on these funds to come through, Holden recounted in a TikTok Live on February 13th. He said he was told the money was frozen and it was not clear when or if the payments would happen. Then, to be honest with you, I just kind of zoned out. I started running numbers in my head. I was trying to figure out how I could make this work, Holden said. He already works another job to try to make ends meet on the farm and cares for his cattle after work. He says the debt on this project can mean disaster for his farm. When asked on a scale of 1 to 10 what his confidence was the payment would come through eventually, Holden, who voted for Trump, rated the possibility a 1. I guess I have a little bit of hope I will see the funding, but I am not too confident, Holden said in the TikTok Live. Farmers are left wondering. Representatives from farm advocacy groups and cooperatives say they are hearing similar stories from their members, but most are unwilling to speak publicly for fear of retribution. Many large farm organizations back Trump's successful presidential campaign. We continue to hear from family farmers and ranchers about the federal funding freeze, which has created significant uncertainty, said Rob Leroux, president of the National Farmers Union, an advocacy group that represents 220,000 farmers and ranchers in 33 states. The interruption in funding raises concerns about whether the USDA will disperse already obligated funds to farmers who have existing agreements with the department. The lack of clarity is leaving state and local agencies and partner organizations struggling to interpret and implement federal programs, while farmers are left wondering if they can rely on those programs as they make critical business decisions for the year ahead, Leroux said. The financial implications are huge in the administration's efforts to freeze or cancel funding. One of Trump's first executive orders calls for a pause on all funding from the Inflation Reduction Act enacted by Democrats during the Biden administration, which provided nearly $20 billion for farmland conservation programs. Another directive briefly paused all federal financial assistance. Other executive orders put a freeze on all foreign aid and dismantled the U.S. Agency for International Development, significant for American farmers because it purchases grain and goods for food programs and funds some agricultural research projects. In limbo in Colorado, Ray Palsgraf is trying to navigate the uncertainty on his 2,000-acre gluten-free grain farm in northeast Colorado. He is struggling to get the farm refinanced, and a recent lender told him they would not calculate government payments, long considered a reliable backup for farmers, as part of his income, even if he has ongoing contracts. His federal contracts have not been canceled, so far as he knows, but he's afraid to spend money on them or pursue new projects. My concern is if we get started and spend a bunch of money with the expectation that we will get it paid back, what if we don't? There are limits to what we can do, Palsgraf said in an interview. Palsgraf is also concerned how the pause in USAID programs could affect his farm and others, potentially causing a domino effect on crop prices. USAID is one of the biggest purchasers of sorghum and other excess grains. Without their purchases, those grains could flood the market and drive down prices. And we'll have to end it there. I'm your volunteer broadcaster, Joe Napoli, thanking you for listening to today's Arizona Mirror and encouraging you to stay tuned for our other great programs here on Sun Sounds of Arizona.